Hello, this is Mark Thompson. This is a quick cold open just before the episode of House of Comments that we recently recorded. We actually recorded the episode on the evening of Sunday, the 7th of April, 2013, and we're actually releasing it overnight on the 8th, so the Monday through to the Tuesday morning, the 9th. And of course, Margaret Thatcher sadly passed away on Monday, which is, of course, dominated the news today. We, of course, make no mention of this during the podcast because we recorded it the day before, but we will certainly cover that story next week and we'll have some discussion about her legacy and so forth. In the absence of that, I hope that you enjoy the show.
Hello, and welcome to the 53rd episode of the House of Comments podcast. We had a short break over Easter and now we're back and raring to go. My name is Emma Burnell and I blog at the Labour supporting Scarlet Standard blog, and I'm joined by my usual co-host, co-friend, sidekick, and regular sparring partner Mark Thompson, who is a Lib Dem blogger. Hello, Mark.
Hello.
So, Mark, how was your Easter?
It was good. Yeah, I went down to the countryside for a couple of days and took the dog down. Had a good run with him there, and then we got him back, and he's just been into the vets to have an operation to have all of his left ear canal removed, which was quite interesting, stroke expensive. So
yeah.
he's now running around the house with one of those Buster collars on, those big plastic cone things that he's not very happy about.
So he's not the happiest of doggies.
He's all right now. He's kind of got used to it. The first couple of days, he was really miserable and just kept looking at us like, what have you allowed them to do to me type look. Dogs are really good at doing, I've discovered over the years.
Yes, dogs and children, emotional blackmail every time. So it's been two quite long and interesting weeks, despite the fact that it's been Easter and we're all supposed to have taken a break and had a recess and not talked about politics. Very few of us have actually taken that advice. We had, well, maybe one person did take that advice and decided not to do politics anymore. And there was obviously a very high profile resignation, that of Mr. David Miliband, who has decided to step down as an MP. Mark, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I suppose I have, as usual with these things, I have a number of different thoughts. And the first one is, I guess, in the end, given the way things played out with Ed Miliband having won the leadership and David Miliband having decided he couldn't serve in his shadow cabinet, at least initially, if he wasn't going to come back and serve, then I guess it was inevitable that he would in the end take a decision to take a step further away, because being on the back benches, he was still a focal point for questions. And I mean, I know from reading some of the interviews and stuff with him that he said that it was never possible for him to make any comment on politics at all without it being filtered through this prism of, you know, he came close with the leadership himself, his brother beat him, you know, is it a coded attack on his brother? And I completely understand that whatever he said, it was always interpreted in that way, even though he may well not have meant it like that. Another thing that I heard the other day, which rang true, is the Labour Party are only ever going to have one leader called Miliband. Even if Ed was to stand down, the idea that his brother would then step in, I just think is unrealistic. For a start, Ed is clearly going to be the leader for another couple of years at least, until Labour fight the next election. And, you know, looking at the way the polls are at the moment, he may well be Prime Minister after the next election. And if that happens, he's in for at least another 5 years. The idea that by 2020, David Miliband will still be the heir apparent if he'd have hung around on the back benches is completely unrealistic. You know, it's going to be Chuckuramunna or Rachel Reeves or Stella Creasy. So someone from the new generation is going to have worked their way up the ranks by that point. The idea that it was going to be David Miliband was just unrealistic. But having said that, I don't like this thing that's started to happen in recent years, which is that as soon as an MP decides that, you know, for whatever reason, that they don't want to be involved in frontline politics anymore, that they then just immediately stand down as an MP and resign and leave the constituents in the lurch without an MP for several weeks or a couple of months. And then there's a by-election. I mean, Blair did it as soon as he resigned as Prime Minister. You could maybe forgive a Prime Minister, although, you know, John Major didn't do it. And, you know, there's plenty...
And he has Gordon Brown.
Well, no, Gordon Brown hasn't either, although he is getting a bit of stick for not being in the chamber very much. But, you know, Edward Heath remained an MP for 25-odd years after he lost the leadership of the Conservative Party. And I just think... I don't think it tells a very good story about what politicians are in it for. I mean, even if it is just a perception thing, it doesn't feel right to me. First and foremost, a member of parliament is there to represent their constituents, not for their own career reasons. And I really do think that unless there's a very, very good reason, MPs should hang around and stay at least until the end of the parliament in which they were elected. I don't know what your thoughts are on that.
As someone who's never managed to stay in a job for more than 2 years... I can kind of see that it must feel like a stranglehold. And if you don't feel that your heart is in it, are you representing your constituents fairly? Are you giving them the best that you could? I mean, being an MP is so ridiculous in terms of the way that we treat the job. We have no idea what we mean by the job. We have no job description. There's no parameters to which you must... to which you can measure your success other than these completely made up ones that change all the time depending on the weather and how the commentators decide you're doing in their very rarefied way. So while I might have many things to criticise David Miliband about over time, I don't think for me that stepping down at this moment is one of them. I found the whole thing a little bizarre, to be quite honest. I didn't write about it in the end. I thought about doing so, but I thought, well, I've been pretty critical of David Miliband in the past. I thought he ran a really poor leadership campaign, and that's why he didn't win. He was the front runner. He could have won it very easily. He didn't run the right campaign. And that was one of the many reasons why I was glad that Ed won it, because in the end, I want the kind of person who can run a campaign that knows how to win running my party. It's a small thing, I know. But I found the eulogising from some sections of the political world too much, and the demonising from other sections of the political world too much equally. And I just thought, you know, I'm going to step out of this one. If you haven't got anything nice to say, don't say anything at all, rather than sound off completely unnecessarily at a man who has basically given several years of his life to public service. He may not have always done it in the way I would wish him to, but he's, you know, he's a part of my party and he did some really, really good things, not least bringing in the Climate Change Act, which was a really important piece of legislation. So he is gone and now we need to get over him. And I think the problem with the narrative of he was always there in the background was that he never controlled the people who were saying that well enough. So it was his own side making that a problem in many ways far more than it was anybody else. Now, that may be part of the same character that led him to not follow Jim Purnell over the top when he could have done before the 2010 general election and tried to topple Gordon Brown. I think he is a man of slightly more timidity than he is a man of leadership.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And actually, it's a couple of weeks ago now, but I wrote a blog post the day that he resigned, which basically said that he didn't lose the leadership in 2010. He actually lost it in 2009, I think, when he didn't follow James Purnell, because he demonstrated that he didn't have the killer instinct. You know, I know for a fact that Purnell expected, well, certainly hoped, that David Miliband would follow him. I know because I spoke to someone quite close to him a little while ago, and, you know, they told me. So it was clearly, you know, Purnell's action was clearly, you know, an advance guard for what he hoped would follow. And the fact that David Miliband then didn't do that, but also, if I remember correctly, he took a long time to come out and make a statement backing Brown as well. So that was almost the worst of both worlds. I mean, it kind of struck me a little bit like Portillo, in that Portillo equivocated and he put phone lines in, but then he didn't stand. And it just, it really reminded me of that. And I know that David Miliband didn't want to be another Heseltine. You know, he who wields the knife very rarely inherits the crown, or whatever the phrase is. But I actually think that Miliband will now end up being a lesson in the opposite direction. Yeah, you don't want to be a Heseltine, but you also don't want to be a David Miliband. And I bet he didn't. I bet he certainly hoped he'd never be, you know, a lesson, a warning to future politicians in that way. But I agree with you that I think that, and also he went, I think we've talked about this before on the podcast, in 2008, in July, he wrote, I think it was July the 29th, he wrote an article for The Guardian where he was clearly on manoeuvres, he was clearly at it. You know, he didn't mention Gordon Brown, he was talking about the future of the Labour Party. You know, he was Foreign Secretary in Brown's cabinet. You know, it was a pretty clear signal, and yet he didn't do anything about it. He didn't follow it up. He just did it. He was dithering. He didn't seem to know what he wanted to do. And so by the time it came to 2010, first of all, he seemed shocked and surprised that his brother would also run for the leadership. But his brother, frankly, showed that he had more cojones than him. He went for it. He got on with it.
It has a big clunking birth canal. That's true.
Well, yeah, that's certainly the way it came across. And I agree with you. I think Ed Miliband's got a flash of steel about him that David Miliband just hasn't got.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that, I mean, that's certainly true. I mean, David Miliband, and let's not forget Douglas Alexander, who ran his campaign, ran a poor campaign. I mean, they ran a first-past-the-post campaign in an AV election. And that just doesn't work that way. They, you know, they tried to play clever by getting Diane Abbott in without thinking, you know what, where would her second preference votes go? You know, people who might not have voted because there wasn't a left-wing candidate voted for Diane Abbott and voted 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Now, they weren't going to put David Miliband number two.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was a foolish... Like, you know, they did a number of foolish things like that, and they just assumed it was going to fall into their lap, whereas that was never the case for any of the other leadership campaigns.
Yeah, absolutely. So what do you think about the by-election that's coming up? Do you think there's going to be anything interesting about it at all, the South Shields by-election?
I think UKIP will do very well. I don't think they'll take it, but I think they'll do very well, which will continue the current narrative of, as I've said, you know, if you live in the top half of the country and you don't want to vote Labour, you're now most likely to vote UKIP.
Mm. I mean, they're starting to look like they're the go-to party for second place in a lot of by-elections, which is...
Mm-hmm.
This is quite a topsy-turvy, crazy world we've ended up in, really, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and they are, in many ways, your midterm party. And I don't know that they'll have the kind of strength it'll take to run a general election campaign that'll break through. But they're going to run one hell of a European election, and that is going to be quite considerable. They may well come first in the Europeans because it's the perfect storm for them.
Yeah.
And the perfect place for them to have that storm, as opposed to the Westminster elections, because people don't take the European Parliament very seriously. They're wrong not to, but they don't. So they can see that as the ideal place to tell people that we don't want to be in Europe, or you know, just to have a little protest about politics as usual.
Yeah. Mm. So you're not hearing anything about who the candidates are. Is there anyone interesting or exciting amongst the list of candidates?
Well, the Labour candidates are 4 local people, I think. They're all from the North East. I don't know how local they are to South Shields. I think some of them are South Shields, some of them are a little bit further afield.
Mm-hmm.
And they are generally really nice-looking, fairly ordinary candidates. I think we've got a social worker, a GP, someone who's worked in welfare. So just sort of people who are going to pursue the kind of political and policy agenda that Labour are developing, I guess, you know, protecting the NHS, developing the welfare state, looking after social work. That sounds quite, I mean, it's, you know, it's not the sort of celebrity candidate type by-election, but it's more, I think it will be, you know, your classic local candidate, which I think is a nice thing.
Yeah, so I was going to say, so there's no spitting image sketch writers amongst the potential candidates then this time. Maybe Labour have learned a bit of a lesson from that.
Well, maybe, but I think it's a different kind of profile of seat, isn't it? I mean, I think South Shields has had a very high-profile Labour MP who was a cabinet minister for a really long time, although has been a backbench MP for 2 years, is not your classic backbench MP. So I think that it's not unheard of to go from one to the other generally. I think constituencies kind of like to have a change as good of a rest.
Yeah.
If you see what I mean. In those terms, it's quite common for people to go from having the high profile to the constituency focus.
Yeah. Did you read Mark Ferguson's post on Labour List? I'm assuming you did. About
everything by Mark.
Yeah, well, I thought you did. That's why I said I assumed you did. It went a little bit into the history of what happened when David Miliband was selected. I hope I'm not conflating two different blog posts here, but I definitely read one that talked about how basically he was parachuted in. His predecessor promised that he would not stand down when the election was called in 2001, was it, or 2005, whenever it was that David Miliband ended up getting parachuted in anyway. But as soon as the election was called, 2001, yeah, as soon as the election was called, he stood down, even though he promised he wouldn't. And that meant that the Labour hierarchy got to basically put a candidate in themselves, and they put David Miliband in. And what Mark was also arguing was that the rapidity with which this selection process has been executed really militates against kind of ordinary, in quotes, people having a chance of being selected. It's going to end up being a bunch of the usual suspects. Did you have any concerns about that?
I had different concerns to Mark. I don't think Mark thought we should take our time a little more. I don't agree with that. I want a candidate in place straight away. I think you'll know from having watched what happened in Eastleigh that was really beneficial to you guys.
Mm.
I think, you know, a little bit longer and letting somebody else take the momentum is not a good idea.
That could have actually made a difference in Eastleigh between us losing and winning, actually.
Yeah, absolutely. So I disagreed with Mark on not expediting the process, but I don't see why the NEC, who do the shortlist when it's a by-election, couldn't have travelled to South Shields to do the interviews for that, because that could make the difference between someone who... I think anyone who wants to be the Labour candidate should be able to get to a meeting on a Saturday. They shouldn't have to pay a really expensive train fare because they'll be buying it at the last minute. And having to do all the and, you know, if they're someone who has childcare issues, they should be able to bring their children to the interview.
Mm.
And the Labour Party should be the kind of party that says, yes, of course we accept that. We're a modern party. But I do think that they could have... I didn't have a problem with the speed. I didn't have a problem with the location. I think that when we're selecting by-election candidates, those interviews shouldn't take place in our head office. I think they should take place in the local constituency party office.
Yeah, I mean,
the very least the regional office.
Yeah, and there's an ongoing argument that's been going on for years internally within the Lib Dems about just how London-centric a lot of the processes and procedures and committees and all of the rest of it are, and how difficult it makes it for people who don't live in London or near London to be able to fully participate in things. Mm-hmm. And it's more than just politics, actually. You know, it's the same with the media. I got invited to something. I'm not going to say what it was, but it was a media thing. It was, you know, I would have been on the media, and it was quite a high profile thing I was being invited to. And they said, yeah, we'll get you a car, and we'll, you know, so we can send you home, because it was going to go on till quite late. And I thought, okay, great. And then I sent them a reply saying, that's brilliant. Oh, by the way, I do live outside the M25, so I presume that's okay. And then everything went quiet for a couple of hours. Then they sent me another email through saying, okay, yeah, we can't send a car that far, so it's not going to work. And I thought, okay, well, I really wanted to do this thing. So I got back to them and I said, okay, well, it's all right, I can get the train back. You know, the last train at like 5:05, so that should be okay. This thing, you know, should have, I was pretty sure would have finished well before then. But then they got back and said, well, no, we don't normally wrap up till about midnight, though, so you might miss your last train, so no, sorry. And then I thought, well, I still really want to do this. So I thought, well, I've got friends in London. I can crash over in London. So I got back to them and said, look, you know, I'm sure I can, you know, find a spare room in someone's house to, you know, to stay in that night. So I can still do it. And then they got back and said, yeah, we're not quite sure if we're going to go this way. Now, we'll let you know a bit later on. About 2 hours later, I got another email saying, no, we're going to go a different way. Sorry, but thanks. And it's like, you know, if I'd have just said, yeah, I live in London, I'm certain that they would have been fine. It was because I didn't live in London that they started getting all funny about it. And it's like, you know, even though I was willing to go well out of my way, and it just, you know, it makes you realise just what a London-centric focus there is in this kind of political media world. You know, I only live 30 miles outside of London. So God knows what it's like for people who live 100 or 150 or 200 miles away from London or in Wales or Scotland. I mean, I think one of the nice things is that, you know, we are starting to see a lot more kind of, you know, regional focus, like with the Salford Centre and so forth. So maybe it's not quite that bad with media stuff. But yeah, with political parties, I mean, you know, I was arguing internally within the Lib Dems that we should make a lot better use of, you know, like video conferencing and Skype and that sort of thing. But I'm not sure there's been many moves in that direction, to be honest. The default is just still, let's just do it in London. That's where most people are.
We have some stuff that's quite good. So we always, or nearly always, set up a phone conferencing. So if you're on, for example, I'm on the Joint Policy Committee of the National Policy Forum, the JPC of the NPF, as we like to call it, which kind of is the executive sort of body for the National Policy Forum. And we will all, although we meet in London, there's always, you know, phone conferencing able to happen for that meeting, so that people, because we do have representatives from all over the country, and the National Policy Forum is specifically designed to have equal regional representation. So the National Policy Forum reps get voted for from the different regions, so you get X amount from each region. And we have an office in Newcastle, for example, so quite a lot of our stuff does get done in the north, and quite a lot of our admin and all the conference arrangements gets done from the north. And the National Policy Forum meets around the country, and that's used as a media opportunity around the country. So we've been to Wrexham and Gillingham and Birmingham. So we're taking a few steps to make sure, and I think that may be in part because of the nature of the Labour Party. We do have strong representation in the north, so that's always been a strong voice, that's important, and that we cannot be just London centric because it knocks out a huge proportion of our members.
Yeah, and you have more women parliamentarians as well, don't you? Wonder if that has helped culturally, because, you know, traditionally women are the ones who have to think more about childcare. I know that's probably quite a sexist thing to say, but I think it's just a reflection of the reality of, you know, kind of how things have developed over the decades. It's changing, but I don't know, maybe there's a factor of that involved as well. I'm not saying, by the way, that the Lib Dems are dreadful on this. They have done some moves in this direction, and I know, you know, plenty of us inside have kicked up a fuss. For example, the conference in autumn is in Glasgow, you know, so that, I mean, that's a good, actually, for me, that's quite difficult to get to. I'm thinking, why couldn't it have been down south? But that's just because I live down south. The people in Scotland are always having to travel all the way down to Brighton or Bournemouth or, you know, wherever it is. So, you know, that's only fair, and it's good that that's happening.
Yeah, Glasgow's a really odd place to have a conference, though.
Is it?
I'm surprised there's enough accommodation. I mean, don't get me wrong, I really love Glasgow. I've had some great times out in Glasgow, and it's a really, really fun place to be. But I didn't expect, I mean, the reason they've always done it traditionally in these seaside towns is because there's loads and loads of accommodation there.
But there's been a big move away from that in recent years, because it's been Liverpool, it's been Birmingham, and it's not just all the parties have started to do that.
I mean, it may be because party conferences have become a smaller beast. Less people are going along to them. So that may be why they're able to bring them to new places. It would be interesting. I'd be interesting to see how you get on in Glasgow. And if it works, it should absolutely be something we should be considering. Glasgow, Cardiff.
Yeah.
You know, it's really important that we don't just go to the places that we've traditionally always gone.
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, I think one of the things that I really like about the way that Ed's taken charge of the Labour Party now is he is really trying to get out there a lot more and go around the country talking to people and listening to people. I think that's a big part of the Arnie Graff community work that's happening. So they'll go and they'll look at the projects that Arnie's doing, and Ed will do a Q&A, which, to be fair, I mean, I'm sure they do a lot of Q&As because it's a really good format for him. He knows he can work it very well. But I think it's just important that instead of just being someone who talks at you from London, he's someone who talks to you where you live.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, you know, that's something that Clegg and Cameron have done as well with the... Clegg hasn't done it so much recently, but certainly when he was... Before he went into government, he used to do lots and lots of little local kind of village hall type meetings, and Cameron did loads of them as well. I went to one of them in Reading. So I think it's something that has been going on for a while, that, you know, the party leaders have recognised that they need to get out and about a bit more. I have to say that this idea of having the cabinet meeting in different places around the country, that irritates me. I think we might have...
No, that's just patronising. That's ridiculous. I always say this, don't move your meeting to another place just to talk to the same people in another place, and then you all come back on the train together.
Yeah.
That's just stupid.
I mean, that is what happens. I mean, I suppose in their defence, they go and visit businesses and, you know, various things wherever they happen to be. So there is sort of a point to it, but it always, to me, just feels like a gimmick. And also, it must make cabinet meetings cost a hell of a lot more on the occasions when they do it. You know, I mean, there's plenty of other mechanisms, you know, local constituency MPs and ministerial visits. You don't need to move the entire cabinet to another part of the country. And you know why they do it? It's because it makes the news, doesn't it? The cabinet meeting is suddenly, you know, second or third on the, you know, on the news at 6 or at 9 or 10 or whatever. So they just get more coverage for it. But, you know, the more it goes on, the less coverage they get anyway, because it's not a news story anymore.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Okay, so I think we've probably covered quite a wide range of constituency-based issues on the back of David Miliband's resignation. But there has been another big story this week, which has been, well, do we count this as one or two stories? And that really is the question, isn't it? This week there was a lot of the things that were due to come in under the Welfare Reform Act started. So the bedroom tax, the loss of certain council tax benefits, one of the universal credit pilots has started as opposed to the four that were originally supposed to start. And there has been a big discussion on the back of that about welfare reform and whether what has happened has been the right reforms, whether there needs to be more reform. And secondly, and separately, there was the judgment and summation and sentencing in a very, very nasty court case in which a man called Mick Philpott, his wife Mairead, and their friend, whose name I don't remember, were sentenced quite severely in terms of manslaughter. I think they were given the highest, certainly Mick Philpott was given the highest possible sentence under the terms of manslaughter. And quite rightly, they committed the horrendous crime where six children died accidentally in a fire that they had set deliberately. And some people have decided that these two stories are the same story, and that what caused the behaviour of Mr. Philpott was the fact that he was the recipient of certain benefits from the welfare state, and some other people have taken offence to this. Where do you stand, Mark?
Yeah, I mean, I personally feel like we do need to separate these two things out. Maybe just talk about the welfare changes first. Obviously, they've come in. And we've got what is referred to as the bedroom tax. I'm not going to have another argument about the nomenclature. You know my feelings on that, but whatever you want to call it, it's now come in. And there have been other changes as well. I think there's the benefits are only rising by 1%. And I think there's been, is it now that some people have to pay a proportion of their council tax themselves as well?
Yeah.
And I think they've all come in at the same time. I mean, I've said before in this podcast that I think the bedroom tax is, I agree with the principle, but the execution of it has been dreadful. Timing's bad. And the way that certain members of the government, all of whom are Conservatives, have tried to, you know, paint this picture and set up these dividing lines between scroungers and skivers and, you know, the deserving...
Mark, I'll interrupt you there, because I don't think it has just been Conservatives who've been using that kind of language.
Okay, which ones
of our lot? Danny Alexander is in The Sun over last weekend talking about bedroom blockers regards to the bedroom tax.
I think we've talked before about how Danny Alexander seems to have gone native. So he's obviously just, you know, parroting whatever the Treasury line is. And I don't know who's...
I can call him a Tory without you having a go at me.
Well, I, you know, there's things that he said that I don't agree with in the past, and this is clearly another one. That one had escaped my attention, but it's been predominantly the Tories that have been banging on about this, and certainly a lot of Tory backbenchers. You can see it feels like they're being thrown some red meat to me. You know, it kind of goes with the grain of what the Tories traditionally do and like to see, and it goes against the grain of what the Lib Dems traditionally like to see. So I think, you know, that's probably the way I would term that. It's been quite interesting, though, to read what Liam Byrne's been saying in the last day or two, because I've got to say, there was a blog post, actually, where someone juxtaposed comments from Liam Byrne and Ian Duncan Smith. And actually, when you looked at them, you couldn't really tell the difference. He certainly seems to be trying to harden Labour's line on this now. There's nothing specific, but he does seem to be talking about how... you know, people need to contribute before they can take out. And I don't really understand how that can work, frankly, because the whole point of a welfare system is that, you know, you pay in when you're in work and you take out when you're not in work. And some people are lucky and have jobs a lot of the time or all of the time, and other people are unlucky and have jobs very little of the time or not at all. And sometimes that's through no fault of their own. So the idea that it can be somehow contribution-based, I don't really understand how that can work. But
I think that, I mean, I have read the stuff that Liam Byrne said today. There are three things that have some people up in arms and some people less up in arms. The three main ideas are a contributory principle, which, from what I understand, would mean that not that you don't get anything if you haven't contributed, but that you may get more if you have. So it might reflect the level of wages and taxes that you've paid down to a minimum that we already have. It's really complicated. I mean, I'm not a massive fan of the contributory principle because I think it's really bad for women who don't contribute financially, perhaps, but are probably, as we've discussed before, predominantly contributing in terms of unpaid labour like childcare or housework.
Yeah.
So I think that there are, unless you can be really conscious with the contributory principle, that you don't simply break this down to basic financial contribution. And if you don't, then it gets really difficult to actually enforce. I'm not massively in favour of it. The second is the idea that people should recognise housing associations and councils can consider work as an aspect when allocating housing, which is something I'm massively in favour of, because I think that social housing must be a mixed community. If social housing is only given to people who are out of work and at their most needy, you just build ghettos. Those need to be communities which are successful and thriving and have a hugely different population. And there should be no... This is why I don't have a problem with high earners living in social housing. I think perhaps you might want to consider how they could contribute more to their rent to build more housing. But I don't think that you say to people, you are successful people don't live round here. So I think that it's really important that we do think about social housing on a much broader basis than simply the most needy get the housing. I'm trying to remember what the third aspect was, which I've completely forgotten now.
Okay. I mean, just coming to those points, I see your point about the second one. I just can't help but feel, though, that if we were in a parallel universe where Liam Byrne hadn't announced this and Labour hadn't announced this, and if those proposals had been put forward by the Conservatives or the Lib Dems or the Coalition, the Labour would be against them, because it sounds like the sort of thing where you put a fairly positive spin on it, where you talked about how people who...
I've been saying this for years, so I wouldn't be against it.
OK, well, fair enough. So you're obviously being consistent.
And I have a housing background, so Labour are kind of listening to the people who talk like me a lot at the moment.
OK, well, that sounds good. But, I mean, it does, you know, Labour in opposition have been very strongly against things that, by implication, what was in their manifesto and what, you know, was being said before the election, they'd have had to have done themselves anyway. And I just wonder if something like this, where you've got, you know, if people are contributing or are taking out more than others, from the welfare system because they contributed more in national insurance or whatever, that does start to set a kind of, I mean, you know, if you wanted to put a really negative spin on it, a kind of apartheid within the welfare system where some people are getting more and other people are getting less. I know you could say that you keep it to a basic minimum, but I'm sure there would be people campaigning. And even if this went ahead, say a Labour government put it in, I'm sure there'd be people on the far left who would be saying that that's not fair either.
Oh, I'm sure that's true. But, you know, what people on the far left say is not always the most sensible thing for the Labour Party to say. I think that in terms of... Sorry, I remember what the third item was, and the reason I've forgotten it is because we've actually been saying it for yonks. It's not new. Dan Hodges can say it's new as much as he likes. It's not. Which is basically... And the reason why any of this would work, and it only works when you start from this basic principle of having a full employment strategy. And if you start everything from a full employment strategy and from actually making the central part of what you think about welfare is making sure there are jobs for everybody to do and making that, you know, in a very Keynesian way, making sure that that's how you deal with welfare is make sure that you're focusing on jobs rather than focusing on welfare, then actually that's a much, much more sensible approach to what's needed. In terms of the high payer, low payer thing, I think the issue is, if I were to get help with my mortgage and my neighbour who lives across the road in a social housing flat were to get help with their rent, those would be two very different sums of money. But we'd both equally be helped the same to stay in the house in which we were living when we were working if we lost our jobs. So there are, it's not as simple as everybody gets the same already. So we can't pretend that we're starting from a basis where everybody gets the same amount of money and gets the same amount of help, because there are different, you know, we've already always had local housing allowance, or well, not always, but for quite a long time. You know, these things have been allocated on the basis of local rents. They've been lowered by the coalition government. So instead of getting the average of 50% of your local rent, you now get the average of 30% of your local rent. So, you know, there are differences in the numbers, but you can't pretend that we are starting from... And I say I have problems with the contributory system, but I want to talk about the right problems rather than pretend that there are new problems that it will bring that already exist within the system.
OK, so I take it from what you've said then that Dan Hodges' argument, I read his piece today as well, that you completely dismiss, because he was saying that basically Labour don't have a policy on this, that they've been dithering around for the last 3 years, and then finally, as soon as Mick Philpott's been sentenced and the heat is on because the Mail's got its headline, which we'll come on to in a minute, I'm sure, that they've panicked, and in the last 72 hours they've cobbled together some kind of, you know, Heath Robinson set of policy announcements, and they've just come out with it, but actually they don't know what they're doing. And he painted a rather interesting picture of a leader of the opposition flying by the seat of his pants without any pants on, which I didn't quite understand.
Dan Hodges in hates Ed Miliband, shocker.
No, I know, but it's
Dan Hodges talking about what Dan Hodges talks about. It's not what anybody else thinks, really. You know, the reason Dan Hodges only gets retweeted by The Spectator and people on the right is because they love being able to say that a Labour so-called activist writes this stuff, but it's bollocks. And, you know, it everybody knows it's bollocks. Bless his heart. I mean, Dan has his little role in life to be the new John Rentoul, or sort of negative John Rentoul, whereas John Rentoul's role in life was to eulogise Tony Blair. Dan Hodges is the sort of negative version with Ed Miliband. And that's his right. He's, you know, freedom of the press and all that. I don't want to stop him. I just don't particularly care what he has to say.
OK, that's a nice... nice summation of your view of Dan Hodges, but in terms of what you said,
but it's bollocks, because we have been talking about this for ages. It's like the immigration thing, the idea that no one's talking about immigration. We can't bloody shut up about it.
Yeah, no, I agree with that.
Yeah, we have been talking about welfare. We have been talking about the contributory principle. We have been talking about full employment strategies. We have been talking about housing allocations. I've been in the meetings where we've been talking about this stuff for a year. So I don't know where Dan Hodges has been and who he's talking to, but I don't think anyone he's talking to has been in any Labour Party meetings for at least a year.
Maybe he doesn't speak to many people in the Labour Party anymore. Maybe that's the problem. So, I mean, just in terms of broadening this out, I don't want to link the welfare changes and anything to do with welfare, really, with Mick Philpott and what happened there, because I really don't think they belong in the same discussion in that way, certainly not in the way that some people like, you know, the Daily Mail and George Osborne and even the Prime Minister apparently would have us. But I mean, the argument has been that, you know, that Philpott is a product, I think is the word that the Mail used, of the welfare system. You know, he had 17 children and he had two partners who he was living with. So one was his wife and one was his girlfriend. And they were claiming child benefit, and then there were all kinds of other benefits that they were claiming. I've seen some figures it added up to 60,000, and I think they were claiming that, you know, if that was a tax after tax income, it would be 100,000. But, you know, the idea that Mick Philpott committed this crime because of the welfare system is so hopelessly simplistic as to be utterly risible, as far as I'm concerned. I can't. You know, I'm not denying that he was on benefits and he claimed a lot of benefits. That is definitely true. But we know in 1978, he stabbed a former lover of his, I think 21 times, nearly killed her. And that was nothing to do with welfare. You know, this man was just a horrible, nasty piece of work. And I'm sure whatever welfare system we had, you know, it was basically immaterial. He would have lived the way he wanted to live under any system, and he would have been capable of probably all sorts of horrible crimes under any system. So I really, you know, the Mail's front page on Wednesday, I thought was disgusting. You know, the fact that they were explicitly trying to link the welfare system with this man, who by any stretch is such an extreme case. You know, how many parents have set fire to their own home and killed six of their own children? How often has that happened? You know, hardly ever. It's such a rare thing. I mean, to the point where I actually did a blog post yesterday where I mocked up a kind of a fake front cover of the Mail, where I actually made the point, which I've heard other people make as well. This isn't kind of, you know, my unique insight, but I made the point that Stephen Seddon, who was recently convicted of murdering his own parents for the insurance money. You know, I don't remember the Mail having a front cover that said vile product of inheritance and talking about how evil the inheritance system is and we should raise inheritance tax or even abolish inheritance altogether and the government's under pressure to review inheritance laws. You know, there was none of that. You know, when it comes to crimes like that, and there was another crime, wasn't there, where a man was going to lose his entire livelihood, but he'd been very wealthy and he shot his wife and his children and his dog and then himself. And again, the coverage that the Mail gave to that was all about, you know, it was almost sympathising with him that he couldn't bear to see his family in you know, in penury. And therefore, he took the easy way out. I don't think they used quite that phrase, but the coverage was definitely different. And it just shows that that coverage from the Mail, their agenda is to just bash welfare claimants. They don't care about, you know, the children who died. You know, this is a tragedy. These children died. And the Mail are using this to try and push the loathsome agenda that they've been pursuing for decades. This idea that welfare claimants are just, you know, basically all on the take and scroungers. You know, it's absolutely disgusting. And also, George Osborne made some comments. Now, he was very careful to not make the direct link. He used a kind of classic political distancing language, but still had the dog whistle in the background where he was saying, well, you know, questions need to be asked and answered about this. You know, about the role of our welfare system. And, you know, he knew exactly what he was doing. He knows how politics works. He knows that he was implicitly making the link and firing a starting gun on this debate and allowing it to run and run and run with the authority of the Chancellor and ultimately the Prime Minister, who, you know, tacitly backed his statements as well. And, you know, I almost despair about this. One good thing is that that blog post that I did is one of the most viewed blog posts I've ever had. It's had, you know, over 10,000 hits, which is, you know, I think demonstrates just how strong the feeling is for this, that, you know, people see something like that on a blog and they actually, you know, they want to read it and they want to comment on it because, you know, I think a lot of people are disgusted with this.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that the Mail probably went too far, but they are the government outriders. The Mail goes too far, so when the government do something that's only a little bit shittier, they get to go, well, we're not extreme as the Mail, we're where the centre ground is. The thing that really, really bugs me is that everyone's going, we need to start this conversation about welfare, as if there wasn't a massive, massive life-changing bill called the Welfare Reform Act that went through a year ago. you know, the idea that this is, you know, the government are now going to get tough on welfare is fucking terrifying. Absolutely terrifying. And, you know, not so much for me, who may soon be unemployed, but certainly is less likely to be in a bad situation than most people. But, you know, for those people who are already being kicked massively, you know, from every which way, the idea that the conversation on welfare hasn't started yet just is so frightening to people, so frightening. And it has nothing to do, I mean, quite apart from anything else, two-thirds of the Philpott household worked. You know, they got some in work benefits, but these were not unemployed. Those two women in that household were not unemployed scroungers. And the other thing is that one of the things that is coming in, or is supposedly coming in, as a result of the Welfare Reform Act, is universal credit. And one of the aspects of universal credit means that it's paid by to a household rather than to individuals. So apart from the child benefit, which is not included, all the child tax credits would all be paid to an individual, which means that it makes it much, much harder for women to do the things that you know, poor Lisa Willis did and leave. Much, much, it's much harder to leave. And that's a really worrying aspect of universal credit. So while, you know, I don't want to be doing what the right are doing and drawing lessons, you know, Mick Philpott managed to do what he did without there being universal credit. So I am not blaming universal credit for what's happening. But I'm saying if you want to take some lessons on the welfare state, one of them might be that the household control of benefits rather than individual control of benefits has problems.
Yeah, I mean, I think this plays to a slightly broader thing, that because some of the trials that they've been running of universal credit have had real problems where people, instead of rent being paid directly to landlords, instead it's being paid to the individuals and then it's up to them to pay the landlords. And what started to happen is that, you know, they've started ending up in arrears, and also, you know, rather than weekly payments, it's monthly payments. Yeah. So people are having to budget and manage their finances. And it's very easy for, you know, people in the cabinet and, you know, senior civil servants who are just naturally very good at managing money, you know, usually. I mean, some people aren't, but, you know, even if they're not great at it, they've probably got enough money that it's not such an issue. But if they were living hand to mouth and then they suddenly switch from weekly to monthly, and sometimes, you know, the people that are affected by this live in rather chaotic circumstances. And I think what it speaks to is a lack of understanding of the lives that some people lead. And it almost seems like it never occurred to them that if we'll just switch from weekly to monthly, because that's how most people who have a job are paid, and therefore it's preparing them for the world of work, so we'll pay them monthly and it'll all be fine. Well, it turns out it isn't fine. In a lot of cases, it isn't fine. And it really just does seem like they don't understand what they're legislating for. I mean, I've said before that I think universal credit is going to collapse. I think it's going to be, it could be this government's poll tax. It could be worse than the poll tax. Not necessarily because it's such a dreadful idea. I don't necessarily disagree with the principle of it, but it hangs on a massive computer system that has to work perfectly straight out of the box. And I just don't think that's going to happen. And I think the trials have proven that that isn't going to happen. They've had failure rates of something like 30%. And the idea this is going to be rolled out, I just think they're on a hiding to nothing with it, frankly.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's absolutely. I mean, I think there is, going back to what you were saying before, I think, and I keep meaning to write about this, and I don't want to completely just give away all my blog, but basically, I think there is a huge, huge problem with empathy across the board in politics. And I don't think this is just a rights issue. I think that it is, as you said, quite rightly, very hard for very rich people to empathise with very poor people, and they don't seem to be trying very hard.
Well, actually, sorry to interject, but this actually ties in with something else that happened this week, which is Ian Duncan Smith claimed that he could get by on £53 a week. And that really just feels to me like that's someone who doesn't really know what they're talking about, because the idea that he could get by on £53 a week, I think, is just ridiculous. But another interesting
thing. Very easy to do, getting by on £53 a week, if you know that you won't have to for long.
Exactly. That's
really, really hard is to know that there's nothing else.
Yeah.
And that's what it's going to be like forever and ever.
That's absolutely right. The other point I was just going to make, though, is that Mark Pack did an interesting post today where he looked at some of the data around some of the polling that's been done about this. And it turns out that the higher up the income scale people are, the more that they think that they could get by on £53 a week, which seems a bit paradoxical. But actually, when you think about it, I saw someone on Twitter say this, that the higher up the income scale you go, the more people just pay with a card, they just sign a piece of paper or punch in a pin, and they don't even really think about how much things cost. They don't realise that £53 a week wouldn't get them, you know, a tenth of what they spend down at Tesco's during a typical month. They just don't quite get it. And the further up the income scale you go, the more out of touch you get.
And I think that's right. But I do want to make a non-partisan point here, because I think there are issues of empathy across the spectrum. I think sometimes the left, particularly the middle class left, can be very gung-ho about saying that they are supporting the working class without actually listening to what the working class is saying to them about people on benefits. Because quite often it is people on the lower end of the income scale who are working, but the working poor, who have the most ferocious views on people on benefits. So it's really, really important that you take those people with you rather than simply telling them they're evil, wrong, and not the proper working class that we want to represent, which is a lot of what's coming across from the angry left, as it were. Yeah. And I think, but there's also a difference in terms of the empathy between the political parties. I mean, I see this all the time. Some people in Labour, and I'm going to do Labour Tory here, and I'm sorry for leaving the Lib Dems out, but to be honest, it's because you have a left wing and a right wing rather than a fixed position, if you saw it in these terms, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
So some people in Labour talk about the Tories and what they want to do on welfare as if they are actually evil, as if these are people with no social conscience, with no morals. And I don't think that's right. I think that the Tories have a moral code. It differs from ours slightly, and it has different outcomes from ours. But they are not, they believe that welfare is a moral ill, that people are trapped on benefits, and that by giving them money, you are not helping them, you are hurting them. Now, I don't think that's necessarily right at all. I'm very strong in terms of you should get people into work, and everyone who can work should work because it's better for you. And I get kicked by some of the left about being that gung-ho on that all the time. As far as I'm concerned, that's the definition of from each according to their ability to each according to their need. But there you go, which is Marx, by the way. On the other hand, you get Tories who really genuinely believe and talk about this all the time, that welfare is Labour's way of having clients, that we're paying for votes, that the only reason we're interested in giving people at the bottom end money is because they're likely to vote for us and we have to keep them sweet. And that equally, and you know, equally considering us to be immoral and evil and heartless, slightly more strategically heartless, possibly, but equally, you know, in the same scale, they consider us as evil as we consider them. And so on and so forth, which is equally wrong. I have never in my 25, nearly 30 years of Labour Party membership ever heard someone make that argument or make anything resembling that argument or say something that could even be mistranslated as we need to give these people money because they vote for us. It's simply not the case that that's the way that we view the welfare state. And I think that part of the problem we have with this debate is that we're talking to each other in such pointedly useless terms that it just removes everybody who's not partisan from that debate.
Yeah, it's an interesting point because, funnily enough, I was thinking pretty much exactly what you just said today. I agree with you about the, you know, the Labour side, and I've heard this thing, the client state, before, and I agree that that is silly. I was actually thinking from the other side, the first side you said, and I was very pleased to hear you say it, because I think a little bit too often, maybe I follow the wrong people on Twitter, I don't know, but a little bit too often I see this argument that they're just evil Tories, you know, and the hashtag same old Tories and evil Tories and all the rest of it, and, you know, harking back to Thatcher and using Thatcher as a club to beat all Tories with. I just find it very, very tiresome because it's intellectually lazy as well. It doesn't engage with what's going on. It doesn't engage with the reality, which is what you said, which is that most Conservatives don't go into public life because they're evil and they want to bash the poor. They do it because they think that the way that they can improve society is by structuring things in such a way as, you know, it will improve poor people's lives by encouraging them to get jobs and all the rest of it. You know, they just have a different approach. And, you know, it's the same kind of problem as I see when I debate drugs policy with people. I had a debate on my blog, actually, with Peter Hitchens. I wrote a blog post about him, which wasn't actually very nice about him, although I was making a slightly broader point. But to be fair to him, he came on and we had a debate. But one of the things that I said to him during our debate, and there was several back and forths in the comments, was that I would really appreciate it if he would at least treat me with the courtesy of acknowledging, even if he disagrees with me, that my motives are good. Because I always understand that people who disagree with me and wish to keep drugs illegal are motivated by what they think is the right thing to do. They think keeping drugs illegal is the right thing to do, and they have various arguments as to why. I think they're wrong, but I don't question their motives. Whereas what happens too often, as you just talked about, is that people on the left just think Tories are evil, and people on the right just think, you know, Labour have this client state thing, and, you know, and you're right, it doesn't get us anywhere. And you're right, it does squeeze out the moderate voices, because the moderate voices, I mean, I would probably consider myself a moderate voice. You know, often, it's probably a typical Lib Dem, often I hear arguments from the left and I think, yeah, that's a very good point. And then I hear arguments from the right, and sometimes I agree with some of those points as well. Now, that's probably one of the reasons why I didn't join either the Tories or Labour, because I actually do feel like no one party actually has the monopoly on good ideas. And I think it would be terrible if for the next 50 years we just had either the Conservatives or Labour in power. I don't think that would be good for anyone.
It's true, we should never have the Tories in power.
I think you're willfully missing my point, Emma. But anyway.
Anyway, I think we ought to wrap up because we have gone for over an hour now.
Oh, dear.
But yeah, that's what happens when we don't talk to each other for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Mark. I thought it was really, really interesting, despite the fact that it wasn't particularly Lib Demi middle ground. So it's quite an interesting place that we've landed. Just like to thank you once again for joining me and for being my co-host on our brilliant podcast. And also thank Audio Boo for hosting and Kevin McLeod at incompetech.com for the music. And I'll talk to you next week.